Good morning. We're going to call the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee meeting to order. Representative O'Driscoll, would you make a motion on the minutes from February 24th, please?
Mr. Chair, I move the February 24th minutes to be approved.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes on February 24th, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes from February 24th are adopted. All right, everyone, we have a fairly full agenda today, so let's please be respectful of each other's time and keep our comments tight, but let's also have a good, thorough discussion. First bill on the agenda is Representative Fenton's House File 501. While she's making her way down to the testifiers' table, I will go ahead and move House File 501 to State Government Finance. With that, we're also welcome Secretary of State Simon to the testifiers' table. Welcome back to our committee, sir. And with that, Representative Fenton, please go ahead and introduce your bill.
Thank you very much. First of all, I want to thank the members of the committee, Mr. Chair. Many of you actually have signed on to this bill. And I want to thank the Secretary of State and their office. They've been a great working partner for this. This bill, House File 501, does three things. First, it allows the National Guard members called to service by the state to use the same special procedures for voting as when they are called to service by the federal government. The second thing is it allows children of Minnesota citizens born abroad to vote in Minnesota if their parents are eligible to vote in Minnesota. And specific to that, that would be a federal ballot-only voting procedure. And lastly, this bill has some technical cleanup. The changes remove outdated and unneeded language and updates the U.S. code cross-reference to the correct cross-reference. So with that, I will allow Secretary Simon to testify on behalf of this bill.
Mr. Secretary, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be with you again. I really appreciate the opportunity to work with Representative Fenton, who's been a great author. She and I have collaborated before she was in the legislature, as a matter of fact. She and I think you, Mr. Chair, were particularly part of a bill. I think you know what I'm talking about, a couple years ago, that was bipartisan and passed with flying colors. So I want to take your advice, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief, and just say that this bill equalizes treatment among those in the National Guard who are called up to service by the President of the United States and those who were called up by a governor. And we have in Minnesota had a long-standing bipartisan tradition of providing accommodations and shortcuts to people who put on the uniform of this country, and that's as it should be. But those accommodations and those shortcuts should not depend, in our view, on whether that person was called into service by a president or by a governor, whether they were called to a foreign battlefield or whether they were called to help out stuffing sandbags on the banks of a swollen river. In either case, they deserve those protections. They have more than earned it. And so this bill is just about equalizing those protections for all who put on the uniform of this country, and we think that's very important. Incidentally, Minnesota, though it is the 26th state in size, is actually the sixth state, ranks sixth in the country in terms of our National Guard contingent. And so we have a greater stake than most states in making sure that there is equal treatment for all of those who put on the uniform of this country. So that's all I really need to say. I want to thank Representative Fenton again for her leadership. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Any member questions? Seeing none, is there anyone else that wishes to testify on House File 501? Seeing none, Representative Fenton will give you the closing remarks.
I'll be very brief. This is a really good bill, and I urge you to vote yes.
Thank you, Representative Fenton. Representative Fenton, I will renew my motion for you that House File 501 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? House File 501 is referred to State Government Finance. Thank you both for your testimony. Next on the agenda is House File 763 and Representative Nash.
I could get a page to help me out.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. As is the tradition for freshmen, I've provided healthy snacks for all of you.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Wasn't that Representative Fenton's first bill?
Not in this committee.
Not in this committee.
In this committee, it was.
Yeah. Anyway, be that as it may.
Well, good eye, and we'll make sure that she rectifies that for us.
Mr. Yes, Chair, for all of you wondering what you're about to eat, it's healthy, it's good for you, and it was made last night by my wife and myself. So, Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to present House File 763. It is a fairly benign bill that has broad bipartisan support. It is essentially allowing statutory cities to set their own electoral filing fees. And to give a bit of a primer, when I served as mayor of the city of Waconia, we tried very hard to make sure that when we had transactional business with the public, that whatever we charge them would essentially get us to the break-even point. And historically, since I believe 1959, the amounts that we have set for statutory cities in the fourth and third class has been respectively $2 and $5. And for all of us, we've all filed for election, and you've gotten that little packet of information that you take with you because they make you. The money that is expended on doing just that puts them in the hole. And I think that we should do the smart thing and allow statutory cities to set their filing fee because it's going to allow them to not put the burden of whatever overage they may have cumulatively on the taxpayer when they have to levy that at the end of the year. So with me, I've got Ann Lindstrom from the League of Minnesota Cities, and she's going to testify as well. And this is a league-sponsored bill. This has got support across the state. I appreciate the members of this committee who are also on this. Representative Joachim, I appreciate your support. It is a bipartisan support, and I do appreciate it. And with that, I will hand it off to Ms. Lindstrom.
Welcome, Ms. Lindstrom. If you would, just introduce yourself.
Sure. Good morning. Thank you, committee chair and members, for hearing this bill. Thank you, Representative Nash, for hearing it, and Representative Joachim for signing on. Again, I'm Ann Lindstrom with the League of Minnesota Cities. Also with me is Daniel Buchholz, who is the city administrator for Spring Lake Park, and the member city that brought this issue to the league and sort of lobbied it through the process, through our policy committees for ultimate approval by our board of director and our membership. So I'll just give a few numbers. Representative Nash kicked it off with some of them, but again, for fourth class cities in the state of Minnesota, so less than 10,000 in population, the filing fee for local elected office is $2. And that was put in statute in 1959 and has not changed since. And same with third and second class cities, so that's population from 10,000 up to 100,000, that's $5. And then the first class cities are $20. That was changed from $10 to $20 in 1967. Charter cities currently have the authority to determine their filing fees. So of the 852 cities in Minnesota, 107 of them are charter cities, and like I said, they have the authority to do it. So even just cities represented on this committee, the city of Blaine would be $5, but their charter has indicated it's $50. Brooklyn Park is $25, it would be $5. St. Louis Park is $25, would be $5. So the bill then just gives that same authority to statutory cities that we already have in law for charter cities. And if there are any specific questions on processing affidavit of candidacy or sort of on-the-ground experience with this, Danny would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Lindstrom. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the question I have, and I don't oppose the bill. I think it makes sense. It's a sensible thing. And as Representative Nash said, that we want to make sure that we're breaking even on what it costs the municipalities to do the work that we're asking them to do. But the question they have, there's no cap on this, and I know if you put a cap on it, it makes problems, but what prevents a city council that may be in some controversy before the next election to jack the filing fee way up to keep people off the ballot? I know there was a lot of talk about that in Minneapolis after the last election cycle that they had, I can't remember, 30-some people running for mayor, up to and including Jack, Jack Sparrow or whatever, the Captain Jacks. Anyways, I mean, so it's that because the filing fee was so low that they argued that, well, that put a lot of people that just, well, I couldn't afford $25 and I could throw my name on the ballot just for the kick of it, and instead of you know, keeping legitimate people off. So I mean, what would prevent a city council from doing that? And I guess that's my question to Representative Nash.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You know, I think that we want to encourage people to be on the ballots. We want to encourage people to participate in the electoral process. I don't want to put a cap on this because I think we've seen that this is sort of vestigial from 1959, and I think that if we can just make this possible, we're going to put it in the hands of responsible mayors and responsible city council members to set what they deem to be an appropriate level. They are far more intimately acquainted with their communities, and they'll know what, from an internal cost perspective, that they should be charging. And I don't want to try to architect people out from running for elected office. And Ms. Lindstrom's got some more information for you. But I mean, ultimately, I want to encourage people to run for office because I think that's a very good thing for them to do, to become active and participatory in the leading of their cities. So I'm a little apprehensive to set a fee that's a cap, because again, we're going to be picking this up again in X number of years, and I just think that from a good governance perspective, from creating a good piece of ordinance that this, or a good piece of statute, that this is the best way to go. And Ms. Lindstrom has some additional comments as well.
Ms. Lindstrom?
Thanks. Just a couple things to add. The process would require at least two city council meetings, so there would be a lot of public notice that would be given to the community, and then testimony could be taken. And this doesn't change the option to submit a petition in replace of a filing fee. And that is, the numbers are the lesser of two, so either 500 signatures or 5% of how many people voted in the last election. So particularly with a lot of our smaller communities, 5% could be really quickly get the petition, and this doesn't change that. And the other thing is, we don't currently have caps in place for the charter cities to be able to do this either.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Nash, and I guess the concern I have, again, is, as I stated at the beginning, what I was said earlier, was that sometimes people in elected office feel that they own those seats, and none of us own our seats even here. We serve at the pleasure of our electorate, but what they would get vindictive, and because of controversy going on, jack the fees way up, so that discourage people from running. And that's a concern that I just want to have on the record. I mean, it's not, I think that would be something that very rarely happens, but things happen, and I guess that's the concern I would have. But I think it's about time that we did this, so it's just putting things out there.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I find myself in the very, very unique situation of agreeing with Representative Nelson on the point and the policy behind the point on this, and that you're wondering why the world was spinning the other direction. The only thing that I would add to help maybe with Representative Nelson's comfort level on this is, state law also states that a municipality, a local government, can't charge in excess of their hard costs necessary to put them at neutral on that. So my hunch would be that if the city council would do that, they've probably been doing it in other areas, so the electorate and the constituency who use those services and have to make those purchases of things would know about that, and they might already be under stricter scrutiny by the electorate and already be engaged in some other communications and correspondence with the state because of that. Once again, mark this date down that you and I agreed. So,
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I would say that, having served, and I know members have served in various capacities at the local level, very intimately acquainted and accountable to the people they represent. And I will go so far as to say I had people question when we added a dollar onto things. So there's that level of accountability that you're getting that frequent question, and that responsible and good governance at the municipal level or at the school board level exists. And the folks are not going to be capricious in the creation of these fees. So I do appreciate it, and it is a good point to make. But I think that we put the trust in the local elected officials, and that we rely on them to lead their community, because historically they've done a very good job, and there are other mechanisms to countermand that if it were to be so. So I do appreciate it.
Any other member questions? Seeing none, we'll give you the closing comments.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for considering House File 763. I think it is a very good piece of legislation. It fixes some problems that have existed long before I would say most of us have been born or were considering running for office, and I think that it's a good time to fix a rather archaic problem. So I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Thank you to the testifiers. With that, I will move that House File 763 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill or for further action. Thank you.
Representative Chair Sanders, welcome to your committee. I hope all is well with you today. We have before us House File 840. Would you like to move that and bring it before the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move that House File 840 be laid over for inclusion in the omnibus bill. And for the record, this will be the vehicle for the elections omnibus bill.
Representative Sanders moves that House File 840 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill that he may want to create this session for the elections bill. Procedurally, there are two amendments in here. Are either those author amendments, or would you like to address them at this time, or how would you like to proceed?
At this time, I'd like to adopt the 8-4. It is an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like. It also puts us a lot more in line with where the Senate bill currently is. And if there are particular questions, or if the committee would like, Ms. Struthers is here from the Secretary of State's office to walk through the amendments if the committee feels it's necessary.
Are you, Mr. Chair, are you going to move the amendment?
And I will move the A4.
Representative Sanders moves the A4 amendment to get the bill in the shape that he would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Mr. Chair, the bill is in the order you want. Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 840, as amended now, is the Secretary of State's Election Administration proposal for 2015. Provides a number of miscellaneous changes and technical fixes for a whole host of things, such as voter registration, absentee voting, recounts, and other general election administrative procedures. It is my intention that this will be the ground floor for the omnibus bill. This is what we will use as a vehicle for elections policy. It's also my intention that this be a very non-controversial bill, and that we can have as near unanimous support of this bill as possible. So my hope is that we will work with Representative Nelson and the Secretary of State to make sure that we have a bill that is best for Minnesota and can reach that threshold of broad bipartisan support. With me today also is Ms. Strother from the Secretary of State's office, who will allow us to do a brief walkthrough of the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair members of the committee, Julie Strother with the Office of the Secretary of State. I will give a very brief walkthrough. If there are specific questions about a section, I'd be happy to answer them, but this will give you an idea of the scope of the bill, and I'll try to highlight what it was in the bill before being amended by the A4 amendment. So Section 1 of the bill ensures that when a school board moves from a 7-member board to a 6-member board, 3 members are up for election at each election, so it's balanced. Sections 2 and 3 provide a definition for partisan and nonpartisan office. Section 4 removes the requirement that voter registration applications be on a paper thick enough for mailing. Section 5 removes obsolete language that applied only in 2010 and 2011. Section 6 changes references from cassette tape to audio file. Section 7 allows voters to return their own absentee ballot on election day. This is something that probably should have been updated when we moved to no excuse absentee. Section 8 allows those ballots that are returned by FedEx or any other package delivery service to be accepted by the after the last U.S. mail delivery. Right now, if they come in after the last U.S. mail delivery, even if they're in before the close of the polls on Election Day, they're required to be rejected. This would say if they come in before the close of the polls, they can be accepted. We think this is particularly important for overseas voters who often use the service to return their ballot. Section 9 allows absentee ballot boards to compare the numbers on the absentee ballot return envelope to either the application or to their voter record in the statewide voter registration system. Section 10 removes obsolete language. Section 11 allows individuals that have a statutorily protected address to omit their address on the public portion of the affidavit of candidacy. Section 12 allows students to serve as an election judge in counties other than the counties where they reside. New Section 13 removes the requirement that the name of each candidate be printed in all capital letters, so it allows mixed upper and lower case. And then there's a string of sections. There are new Sections 14, 15, 21, 23 through 26, 37 through 42. And all of these are updates to the language about how ballots are prepared. Right now it says that you must place an X in a box, and we no longer use boxes. We use the optical scan balloting, and so this updates it to say that you put, there's an oval, and you fill in the oval. It also allows for a similar mark, because we know some voting equipment coming online might use a circle instead of an oval, so we want to allow some flexibility for that voting equipment. New Section 16 ensures that the titles for judges can be printed in mixed upper and lower case. 17, which was former Section 13, conforms the timeline for processing mail ballots with absentee ballots. 18 and 19, which were 14 and 15, clarifies the right to time off for work to vote applies to all regularly scheduled elections, not just the state general election. New Section 20 removes the requirement that voters fold their ballot and hand it to an election judge before putting it in the ballot box. Now with optical scan, the voter puts the ballot in the ballot box themselves. Sections 27 and 29, which were 16 and 18, this doesn't change the timeline for requesting a recount, but does say that you have to have the request in by 5 p.m. on the day that it's due, so that people know when our office will be closed and they can't turn it in. Section 28 and 30 ensures that in the case of a discretionary recount in a primary, the process for preparing the general election ballots is not delayed. Section 31, which is former Section 20, ensures that a contest cannot be used to delay the issuance of an election certificate. This language standardizes the process for all elected officials to the process that's currently in place for Minnesota House and Senate members. Section 32, which is former Section 21, conforms the administrative practice of delivering an election certificate in the case of a special election. Right now, we're required in a special election to give it to the candidate, but in the case of a regular election, we give it to the House or Senate chief clerk directly, and so this allows it to give it to the chief clerk. New Section 20 or 33, removes the requirement that instructions be printed again in all capital letters. 34 through 36 removes unneeded language about other questions voted statewide. We only vote on constitutional amendments statewide. And then Section 43 is a repealer. It has three statutory sections that are repealed in whole or in part. The repeal of 204B-14 subdivision 6 repeals the requirement that precincts follow physical boundaries. This was a request particularly from the cities as they tried to accommodate their precincts to school district lines if possible. It also repeals 204C-30 subdivision 1, which is a requirement that the counties provide copies of summary statements to our office. They're required to keep them and hold them for a statutorily prescribed period of time, but right now they're mailing us additional copies, which then sit in our office, and it's a waste of resources for the counties. And then the last repeal repeals a law which applied specifically to an election in 1990. That is my hopefully quick summary. If you have any additional questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Well, Mr. Others, thank you. Cliff's Notes has nothing on you, I can tell you that. I ask for member questions and testimony from other folks, I do have one quick question on Section 1. Please help me to recall, because I don't at this point, as it relates to school board elections. Have most or all school districts gone to an even an even election year? Because we used to be allowing school districts to basically have elections every year, mm-hmm. where two candidates would be up on the ballot, and so they're on a three-year cycle. I'm just questioning the moving from 7 to 6, where if they're still under that system, it's hard to put three candidates up when you're doing rotating cycles like that without modifying the terms.
Mr. Chair, this is the thing we worked with the school board on. I actually don't know the statistics on how many school districts are operating in the even versus odd year. I know that there are some odd year school district elections this year, but my understanding of those is they are odd year only, and then even year, you know, some are always holding their elections in the even year and some are always holding them in the odd year. But I apologize, I don't have a breakdown on that. The purpose of this, though, is to say that if you had a seven-member school board where one year you're electing three and the next year you're electing four, when you move to a six-member school board, which the law allows, you are not having two up one year and four up the next year, you're having three and three. But I don't know the answer to the number, and I can't get that for you.
We may have an answer from the former chair of this committee, Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, our great staff that we have here, Mr. Geldman whispered in my ear that 60 of the 360 school boards still have odd year elections.
I guess what I'd like to do is I maybe like to just bring in, because we do have the question isn't necessarily odd and even. Mm-hmm. It's that if you have a six-member school board,
yep,
two members are up each year, so you may have in a cycle an even number two up, an odd number two up, an even number two up, and then you're back to the cycle with the first people on that. So maybe you just want to ask Mr. Gehring if he can provide. Oh, he's saying, pick anybody but me. Well, I will do this. In the interest of time in the bill, since we're laying it over, that may be something that we'd want to research and just get clarity, because I don't want to have statutory conflicts at our next general elections.
Mr. Chair, I will follow up on that. I will say I did talk to the School Board Association on this about whether they thought this change would cause any problems or if they had any objections to it. They said they thought it made sense and they reviewed the entire bill, but I will look into that specific question.
Thank you. This is the Committee of Jurisdiction, and committee work should be done in committee, so this is a great place since it's being laid over to make that happen. Members, questions on the bill? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for either the author or just for on line 3.27, it's just a point of clarification. You're announcing that you're going to provide that list to the county auditors at least monthly. My question is, what was it prior to this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, it was monthly. Under the law, you'll see the language that struck below. It required a process for transitioning to us providing it monthly, and so this is getting rid of the language that implemented the transition and moving the requirement that we provide it monthly up into the body of the language. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Strother, for your fabulous, concise presentation. Just so pleased to hear all of the really common sense reforms. I'm particularly a point of clarification. I was following along as quickly as I could keep up with you. I believe it was section 7 on page 4 that you mentioned that the reform was that a voter who had had an absentee ballot issued to them could now bring it in and actually have that be accepted. Is that what I heard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, yes, that is true. Right now, if a voter has an absentee ballot in their hands on election day, they're required to get an agent to turn it in for them if they want to go to the county and turn it in, and this removes the requirement that they give it to an agent. They still can't bring it into their polling place. If they go into their polling place, they would have to spoil that ballot and cast a new ballot in the polling place, but it removes the requirement that they find an agent to bring it in for them.
Representative Pugh, follow-up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Members, any other questions on the bill as the author has amended it at this time? Are there members from the public that would like to comment at this time or share thoughts on the bill as it's been presented by the author? Seeing none, we have one other amendment, the A3 amendment. Who will be offering the A3 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I would
Representative
like to
offer Lane.
That. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the bill we've had in the past for early voting, and I would just like to say we've had absentee voting for a long time with excuses, and last session we passed no excuse absentee voting. This was very well received by the public. In fact, it was called early voting across the state. And my experience, I went into Columbia Heights City Hall to do absentee balloting. ahead of time, and it was a lot of rigmarole where you have to do this envelope, and then you have to fill this out, and then the person has to sign it, and all this rigmarole rather than just simply voting. And my the person that was helping me there said that in Anoka County, they're telling her that it would cost $7 per ballot on a normal basis to do the no-excuse absentee balloting. So it was really kind of a waste of money, very much a waste of money. And Ramsey County, I believe, has done an actual study to say what is, because this was the materials for doing the early voting, but for doing the no excuse, but what about the personnel costs? Well, Ramsey County has done apples to apples because you're going to use personnel to receive the ballot one way or another. So they've just done the cost savings difference, and they've saved 53%. On the, it would take about $6.05 to process every in-person absentee vote delivered to the courthouse, and they would save the cost on this. It would save 53%. So these are, this is what would come off our property tax in the county level. So it's a good county savings thing, and people expect when they go in, they're going to vote. When we go in to vote in a polling place, we cast our ballot and we put it into the machine, and we know that it's there. When we go in and do the no-excuse absentee balloting, we go through all the rigmarole of the witnessing, the envelope and everything, and we set it aside, and we go, well, now, are you really going to, how do I know that gets counted? So the person expects that when they do the early no-excuse absentee voting, they're going to have their vote counted and be assured of that. If we pass this, that would be just what would happen for 14 days before election. 14 days, that's not as much as we have for no-excuse absentee. 14 days beforehand, a person could go in and vote normally at some place in their city, whatever the city sets up, and then it would go right into the machine and be counted right then and there. So it would be a huge cost savings, in my opinion, to the counties to do this. People expect it. People appreciate it. I think it's an excellent idea, and it certainly is a bipartisan issue. Across this nation, we have 21 states now that right now do it. We have an additional 12 that have less restrictive no-excuse absentee voting than we have now. So that's 33 states that are doing an easier job of letting people their vote than we are doing. So, and this is, like I say, across the nation, both Democrat and Republican amounts, the people who vote early in these various states, it varies. Some of them are more percentage of Republicans, some of them are more percentage of Democrats. It makes no difference. It's just people's lives. People's lives require us to offer them something a little bit differently. So I think this is a good bipartisan thing to add to our nice bipartisan bill here, and I know it's moving in the Senate and will be in their bill, so again, it matches up with the Senate. So that's my amendment.
Thank you, Representative Lane. Representative Scott, did you have comments?
I just wanted to introduce the school group that's here. These are ninth grade students from Legacy Christian Academy. That's where my daughter graduated from last year, so they come down. They bring the ninth graders down once a year, so I just wanted to welcome them to the committee.
Well, welcome to the committee, and thank you for spending some time with us today. As it relates to the A3 amendment, Mr. Chair, and the author of the bill, Representative Sanders, your wishes on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Blaine, for bringing this up. It is something worth discussing. I would say at this time, I would like to not amend this onto the House File 840 in light of, I don't know how bipartisan this would be received, and I would like to get as many votes as possible on this bill, and I certainly think that there could be some drop-off without a larger contextual conversation, at least with my caucus. I know that we have a lot of sentiments that we just went through a lot of major change in our election system last year. And while that seems to be very positive, it was a very big change. This, again, in the next election cycle would be another big change. And I think that we need to have a very broad discussion as to what, if we go down this road, what that picture should look like. In how Minnesotans vote, and I think that there are some good opportunities with this. I do think that there is some good additional security, like you said, being able to put your ballot in the tabulator right away. is probably preferable to how the absentee ballots are tabulated at this time. So I think that there is some opportunity for discussion on this. I would like to keep House File 840 as clean and technical as possible. I'm also meeting with Secretary of State Simon early next week to discuss this issue and other elections issues. We'll also want to meet with Representative Nelson to discuss this issue and other issues. So while it's a good discussion, and it's a good discussion to have, at this time I would hope that we would not adopt it onto House File 840.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because it is, like I say, a nonpartisan issue overall, and I think that the people already are calling it early voting, it would be, the only changes would be at the county level. It wouldn't be so much as people's expectations, so I think it would be very simple to move on with it. However, perhaps we could consider it as a separate bill at some point in this committee and have that discussion again later, but I would hope that you would continue to carry forth this discussion.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this this question actually would pertain to Representative Lane, if she would take a question.
Representative Lane, I want to just look for a clarification. Are you looking to withdraw the amendment at this point? I wasn't quite sure with what your intentions were. I know that Representative Albright had a question on it, so I'm just not sure which direction we should go.
Let's see. I think that we can go ahead with a vote here and a voice vote, I would assume, and hope that we can consider to continue this at a later point. Is that your idea?
Representative Sanders, the author of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lane. Certainly, it's your amendment. We absolutely can have a discussion now on it and vote on the amendment. Agree, my wishes would be that we not adopt it at this time, but I would also give you the commitment that we would have a discussion on this bill at a later time.
Okay, I'd like to continue with the discussion, mostly because this is a cost savings to counties.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lane, to your point then about cost savings, my concern would be if you're availing people to vote early, you encumber the counties as well as the state for processing those ballots, opening up a facility to enable people to walk in and take care of the ballots, as well as the state for oversight from the Secretary of State's perspective. So you are encumbering the overall process with additional responsibilities earlier than normal. And so as a compare and contrast with absentee ballot, which is a ballot and a stamp that is held until the time of balloting itself is completed in the general election. So my question is twofold. One, what would be your response in terms of the cost itself, you know, your comments in terms of the cost savings? I think there may be some disagreement on that. But to the point of, would there be a fiscal note attributable to your amendment from the state perspective in terms of accommodating that across the state with as many counties as we have?
Representative Land.
Mr. Chair, we do have somebody here from a county give their county perspective, but my understanding is that this would save every county money. We now have people at polling, someplace they have to have a person on staff to receive the in-person absentee ballot. So that's already in place. And as I say, I know Ramsey County has actually compared this apples to apples, how much it would save them to not have to do all the balloting, all the envelopes, all the storage of the ballot, all the checking later that goes with a no-excuse absentee ballot, as opposed to simply walking in, casting your ballot, putting in the machine, and it's done. It's a big difference in cost savings to the counties everywhere.
Representative Albright, follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm certainly in favor of accommodating those individuals that have restrictions in terms of their availability to a polling place on the day of election. But my concern with your amendment is more to the point of convenience over and above short-circuiting the election campaign process by possibly as many as 3 weeks prior to election. In the event of announcements, in the event of circumstances that would prevail upon a candidacy in those last 3 weeks, that might change the course of a campaign or a constituency that might be voting for that candidate, I think you're in a sense short-circuiting that by prevailing upon people the opportunity to vote early. They have no opportunity to retract that. Likewise, they would not have an opportunity to retract their vote in a absentee ballot. But to accommodate in another fashion a whole new section of the electorate to take convenience into that, I think we have to think about the sanctity of the election day, to consider that there is a finite amount of time that every candidate has an opportunity to campaign within, and to allow for people to make up their mind per se, but not be availed to additional information just up until including the last day of the campaign season. I think to some extent would short-circuit both or all candidates to an election from the standpoint of getting in their final word as it would pertain to their candidacy.
Members, I'm going to just interject, having been an experienced member in elections and government operations since I've been here. You've heard, for members and for members of the public, you've heard members testifying today or sharing in the discussion, having to have broad bipartisan support. And this goes back to wishes of governors. When Governor Pawlenty was governor, he would not sign a bill that came out of the legislature that did not have broad bipartisan support. And when Governor Dayton was elected, he picked up that same mantra, if you will, and moving forward with that. The problem is we don't have a clear definition of what is broad bipartisan support. We don't know if that means a majority of each, the House and the Senate. We don't know if it means the House one way, the Senate the other. And we've never really tested that outcome. And so with something of this nature, there's two concerns that I would have and would caution members as we look to vote on this today. One is this may have some fiscal impact on the state, because the Secretary of State's office would have to put in place some training, some policies and procedures, and I don't know if they're prepared in the budget process right now to deal with that. As I look at the bill as it's being presented today, this is all policy-related matters, and by putting this financial-related matter on a policy bill, could jeopardize the entire bill and its success for the voters here in the state of Minnesota. The chair has suggested that he would like to continue to talk about this, and we can take a vote on it, but I know it's the wishes of the chair at this time to not have, and the author of the bill to not have, this amendment on the bill at this time.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lane.
Thank you. I would just like to speak to some of the things that have just been said. Loosely throwing out 3 weeks when, in fact, the bill says 14 days previous to the election a person could do in-person voting, early voting. So it's 14 days, and a person could take an absentee ballot and up to 7 days before they can change their mind. So there's not that much difference on that. And then I would draw attention to the fact that we make our decisions here for the voters and their what they desire and what works best for the voters, not what works best for the candidates.
Representative
so
Nelson.
We want
I'm
to
sorry,
help.
Representative Lane, didn't mean to cut
you off. We just want to bear in mind who we're actually passing this for. And I will stop.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I understand there's a county official that drove down here from central northern Minnesota that would like to speak on this amendment. Before we go to a vote, can we hear from that county official?
We can certainly allow that individual who took some time to offer some brief comments to the committee, knowing that we will probably be dealing with this issue on a go-forward basis. Good morning and welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and share your brief testimony with us.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you. My name is Debbie Erickson. I'm the Crow Wing County Auditor-Treasurer, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Officers as the chair of the Elections Committee. I just wanted to share that MACO does support and encourage implementation of early voting in Minnesota. The right of every eligible voter to have the opportunity to cast a ballot and make sure that the ballot is counted should be the same right regardless of which location a voter chooses to cast their ballot at. By enacting early voting, voters who are unable to go to the polls on election day are all offered the same standard and experience as those at the polls. You have heard that there is additionally early voting would allow for administrative cost savings on behalf of the counties by eliminating the need for envelopes, processing, work that would increase costs to the counties. Representative Lane did share some of the cost data that has been brought before you. Approximately 50% would be a savings with regard to early voting over the absentee in-person voting process. By offering increased voter confidence and assuring them that their vote has been cast and counted as they intended, and treating all voters fairly and equally, regardless of voting locations and reducing costs, early voting is the next step in improving Minnesota's elections process. And I urge you to consider support of early voting. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on your comments regarding creating good bipartisan election policy. I think that that's really important work, and I think that we've had a history of working for really good bipartisan election policy in this committee. And this is a policy that needs to have a great deal of discussion. This should be broadly bipartisan because it really makes the voting process much more effective for the voter. I know I voted personally absentee in person. I voted. I love being one of the first people to feed my ballot in on election day. I don't know how many other election geeks are around the table that love that. Love to be number one at their polling place and watch that get fed in and see your number one. But the other reason that feels so good is because you know your ballot's been counted, that your ballot is correct, that your ballot is not going to be rejected. There's a certain amount of comfort that comes from a voter being able to know that their vote is counted when they cast it. When you fill out your absentee application, when you fill out your ballot, there are a number of forms that you're filling out, including your ballot, and you put it in an envelope and you hand it to a person and you kind of hope for the best. And we have wonderful county election officials. We have wonderful county auditors that do really keep the sanctity of our election system in really great shape. However, as a voter, if I make an error on one of those many pieces of paper that I'm filling out, it feels a little bit scary. And so the fact that many other states have gone before us and instituted in-person early voting really gives us the opportunity to learn from their processes. This bill reflects what we have learned from their processes and their experience, and ultimately we are creating an election system that works for the voters of Minnesota, particularly when we're looking at people who need special access to the ballot, particularly when people who might be aging and have mobility trouble. And I can tell you, for some reason on election day in Minnesota, our weather likes to show off, and I can't tell you how many snowstorms I've had to go through to vote. And if you're dealing with mobility issues, if you're dealing with transportation issues, getting to the polls on election day to cast your vote in person is a true barrier for a lot of people. No excuses absentee is a great option for these folks, but for them to be availed of the same opportunities that those of us who are able to make it to the polls on election day to have their ballot be counted that day, to me makes a lot of sense, and this committee should continue to consider this, and I do believe that we can get to some broad bipartisan support on that.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. Members, we've had a robust discussion on this, and I will just point out that there is a place in Representative Lane's amendment for an appropriation, so this would require a fiscal note that is a blank line, and it can be found on page 11 of the bill. And I know that the chair is hoping to be able to have a policy bill to be able to have it clean, and has indicated that he would be open to further discussions on the matter. I don't believe that there are any other testifiers, so to the author of the bill, Chair Sanders, your intentions and wishes again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we can, if there aren't any more member questions, move to a vote on A3, and then that would conclude my comments, and we can lay House File 840 over.
Representative Lane, the very last two words.
Just the last comment that... this amendment saves counties money and assures the voters in the same way that Representative Halverson said. But the key thing is that it saves your property taxes.
With that, all those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No. The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. And since the amendment has not, or the bill has not changed since we took public testimony after the author's amendment was on, we'll move to the vote on, move to layover for possible inclusion, further consideration, House File 840. Thank you, members. And the next bill is House File 391, and Representative Erdahl has this bill, and if you'd like to make his way to the testifying table with any witnesses that he has on that bill, that'll help us to expedite our next agenda item.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First of all, we do have an amendment. So,
let's see here. Let me just get my paperwork out here, Representative Erdahl. As I was coming, I didn't hear. Did you move, Representative O'Driscoll, did you move House File 391?
Mr. Chair, we did not. I just invited Representative Erdahl and his testifiers to come to the testifying table to ready themselves.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. I will move that House File 391 be laid over for possible inclusion or further action at a later time. With that, I will move the A2 amendment for Representative Erdahl as an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author wishes. To your amendment, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The amendment is a real simple one. It just changes the age 16 to 17.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Any member questions to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A2, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A2 is adopted. Representative Erdahl, to House File 391 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And regarding House File 391, what it does not do, it does not allow 16-year-olds to vote. It does not allow 17-year-olds to vote. It does not allow data from voter lists to be made available until the age of 18, which is the way it is now. It is not a subversive plan to recruit liberal voters. For groups sounding the alarm, I really wish that they would have had the decency to talk to me about this bill and my intentions. They did not. I know that any members, for example, if they had questions about this, would have come and talked to me beforehand. This bill originated as a suggestion from a high school student. What it does do after my amendment, which, by the way, I announced the day that I was given this bill that I would amend it to 17, that I would not do 16. What it does do, 17-year-olds will be eligible to register to vote. And that's really the entire essence of the bill. Many 17-year-olds already register in Minnesota if their 18th birthday is before the election. I'm not aware of any problems with this. I believe in the value of heightened civic awareness and in our participatory democracy. My purpose in bringing this forward is with those goals in mind. Our republic and its future depends upon it. I would hope that this bill would foster more interest and more participation in our electoral process, and that's all that it's about.
Thank you, Chair Erdahl. Sir, welcome to the committee. If you would introduce yourself for the record, and we'd love to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dan Thomas Cummins. I am an interested citizen as well as a constituent of Representative Halverson's. I'm also the one who originally brought this idea for House File 391 to Representative Halverson and Representative Erdahl. And I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing this bill to come before the committee. And I'd also like to thank Representatives Erdahl and Halverson and too many other people to thank right now for all their hard work in making this idea into a reality. Members, I am proud to bring you this bill today. This bill will allow 17-year-olds to pre-register to vote with the understanding that they will not be eligible to vote until they turn 18. First, I would like to point out how bipartisan this proposal is. In case this bill's list of authors was not evidence enough of this, 22 other states already have some form of pre-registration on the ballot, or on the books. And I know the Minnesotans are eager to see good faith constructive cooperation in our newly divided legislature. So if it is passed, I see this bill serving as an example of how different political parties can come together to provide constructive criticism when necessary in order to create the best common sense policy for Minnesota. And that is exactly what this bill is, common sense. I wrote the bill to increase access to the democratic process by reducing ambiguity and increasing convenience. Minnesota has a proud history of being a high voter turnout state. Unfortunately, voter turnout fell more sharply than usual during the last election. Based on experiences I have had dealing with my peers and discussing political issues, I feel this is indicative of a growing trend among the younger population who has lived a significant portion of their lives under a do-nothing Congress and therefore are feeling generally apathetic about the political process. Mr. Chair and members, I feel that unless we act soon to remedy this apathy, Minnesota has little to look forward to when it comes to maintaining its voter turnout and having a truly representative government. This bill, by allowing students to pre-register at age 17, would help foster a healthy interest in politics and a strong respect for voting. Studies show that young people who register do turn out to vote, by and large. Further studies show that the tendency to vote forms as a habit which, if fostered at a young age, will continue throughout a person's life. Therefore, by allowing young people to pre-register, we are affording them the opportunity to experience the feeling of investing their voice in the direction of their own city or town, their county, their state, and their country. Furthermore, by allowing them to experience this feeling an entire year before they're eligible to vote, they'll be more likely to get involved with civics and pay attention to how their elected officials handle important issues, meeting with their representatives, or even doing what I'm doing right now, participating directly in government. Being involved in these different ways will not only make them more informed voter, but will make them a more consistent voter, a voter who knows the impact of their vote. The current law, which allows 17-year-olds to register to vote if they'll be 18 by the next election, has proven to be ambiguous. I have personal experience with this. I am 18, and I registered to vote on Labor Day of 2013 when I was still 17. I assumed that because I would be 18 by the 2014 election, I should be fine registering. I neglected to remember that we had a school board election that year. So when I tried to register my political science class, the vast majority of my class was concerned that their registrations would not go through because of that election. I thought that it was fine. I had registered and received the blue card confirming as much. Since then, I have heard conflicting descriptions from different people about what should have happened in my case. Some of them lead me to suspect that my name may have been on the voter rolls for the 2013 election. Of course, I did not attempt to vote because I knew that I had to be 18 to do so, but this caused me great concern as I know many of my peers could easily be confused when they see that blue card in the mail before they are 18, or even before they're 18 by the next election. Even my own political science teacher was confused by what the card meant for me. If we set the registration age to 17, we provide a clear definition of when someone can register to vote and help ensure integrity in our elections. Last year, I graduated from Egan High School, where political science and AP government are both senior courses, so everyone in the class will be presumably over 18. This is also the way that we can increase civic engagement among young people. So as the class could be discussing the importance of participating in the democratic process and deciding who represents them and speaks for them in government, the teacher could hand out the registration forms right away. The schools could have forms available in the office. In fact, a 2009 study from George Mason University analyzed Florida and Hawaii's pre-registration laws and found that certain implementation methods contributed most to increased voter registration. These included having registration forms available in schools and other public venues. See, these inconveniences are some of the reasons why Secretary of State Steve Simon is so excited about the bill. Of course, I will let him speak for himself. But we have had many conversations on the issue, and every time we talk about this idea, he recites the same refrain, quote, "It just makes sense." Mr. Chair and members, I hope you will agree with me that it just makes sense that 17-year-olds should be able to pre-register to vote. It just makes sense that there should be a firm time at which young people know they're able to register to vote. And it just makes sense that we should be doing everything we can to ensure our state's future as a strong participatory democracy. I ask for your support on House File 391. Thank you for allowing me to testify today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have to the best of my ability.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas Cummins. That was very sharp, very well done. Thank you.
And Representative Halverson is interested if he wants to run for the legislature.
All right. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to congratulate Mr. Thomas Cummins. He did a wonderful job. It gives us hope for our future when we have bright young men like this coming forward and doing the scary thing of testifying for all of us. We're a scary-looking bunch, I can tell you that. The question I had was kind of tongue-in-cheek, but when Representative Erdahl gave his presentation, he said that it is not a liberal plot to...
Subversive
liberal plot to get more people. I want to make sure that it's also not a subversive conservative plot to get more people. But because I do support this bill. It is a good idea. I think it's moving forward. The more we can engage our young people in the community to get involved, participate, and vote, the better we're off we all are.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Joachim.
Actually, Representative Sanders, could
Representative
I respond
Erdahl,
to that?
Please.
You know, in all seriousness, in terms of, you know, who's going to vote, is this going to suddenly create a whole new group of Democrat voters or whatever? People tend to vote where they live. I mean, frankly, if you are a resident of Cokato and you're 17 years old, you're much likely to vote Republican when you're 18 than Democrat, much more likely. Whereas in Minneapolis, it would be the reverse. You tend to vote, you know, your parents and the area that you live in.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you. I want to thank Representative Erdahl and Mr. Thompson for bringing this forward. And kind of on a personal note, my husband and I have raised our three kids to be very civically oriented, and voting is a big part of doing your civic duty. And we take the kids to Kids Vote at the elementary school. We'd take them to our polling place when we'd go to vote. And I want to thank you for helping young people be more active and engaged. Personally, two of my children, one, she actually turned 18 in August, the week we were bringing up her up to college early for soccer. So trying to fit that voter registration in was really tough. We ended up doing it, but she was nervous that it would go through in time. And our other son actually turned 18 on October 28th. So he had huge worries that his registration would get there in time for him to be able to vote that election cycle on the 4th of November. So I just want to thank you for making it easier for our kids.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I also want to thank Representative Erdahl and Representative Halverson for bringing forth this bill. Just want to mention to my colleagues that a few Sundays ago, a group of young people, some of them are in the audience here today, came to the state capitol. They're part of Jewish Community Action, and there was nothing partisan about it. The first thing they did was learn about, and I was invited to be there with them, and the first thing they did was learn about the history of our Capitol from one of our able staff, and then they listened to me drone on as to why I, you know, chose to run for elected office. They wanted to know about that. And then they spent all of their time talking about how they wanted to get other students civically engaged, and that they thought that this would be a good way to do it, that they were worried about the apathy that is out there now. And I just want to assure everyone that there was no talk of parties, political parties. There was no talk of partisan issues. It was truly pure desire for civic engagement. And so I think it's a great idea. I obviously support this bill and hope that everyone will understand that what Representative Erdahl said is absolutely correct, and this is just brought forward by young people who are the hope for our future and want other young people to be more civically engaged.
Representative Halverson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Erdahl and to Mr. Thomas Cummins. This is wonderful to see you here, and thank you for bringing this forward. I really appreciate your words, Representative Erdahl, regarding making our democracy stronger and providing a voice for our young people. When Mr. Thomas Cummins had approached me with this idea, I did a fair amount of research, as I tend to do, and it's fascinating to me how important it is to have people register and vote and vote in their first election when they're 18. If you vote when you're 18, you're more likely to be a lifelong voter. If you put off that rite of passage, you are more likely to not have your voice be a part of our democracy, and the science bears that out. And it's troubling to me what we saw in election after election, but frankly the last election, the drop-off of 18 to 24-year-old demographic in voters was huge. And we really need to work together as a state to ensure that our young people are ready to be part of the civic process and to have their votes heard. I spoke to a group, we all speak to groups of students, and I spoke to a group of students last week, and they said, what can we do to be part of the process? And I said, first and foremost, make voting a priority, because that is such a vital way to make your voice heard, and it's so important. I mean, this is a right that people have fought for and died for right in this country. Ensuring that our young people have a good understanding of the process, that we do whatever we can to help them register to vote for their first election, and ensure that we have a solid process for them to participate in is vital. So thank you for your work on this. One question that I would have, and I'm not sure if anybody in the audience could answer it, is there is some, I understand it was confusing for Mr. Thomas Cummins to go through the process. I was wondering what the back end of that process might look like, and if anybody might comment on how we manage our voter rolls and how we ensure that eligible voters are the ones that are showing up on election day.
Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Strother. If you would just reintroduce yourself for the record.
Julie Strother, again, with the Minnesota Secretary of State's office. And so I can give a little background on this. We do have a process in place currently to allow folks who will be 18 on election day to submit their voter registration application. It is put into the statewide voter registration system, but it's not made an active record. It's rejected if the person's birth date is not 18, so it's not made an active record. It is in a pending queue, essentially, and there's a job or a program that's run every day to look for when that record then becomes 18, and it's not until they become an 18-year-old or they reach their 18th birthday that the voter application is actually fully processed. Then they become an active registrant, and then they would then show up on the rolls, but they wouldn't show up on the rolls even if they had submitted their voter registration application, you know, and there's an interim election, in your case probably a special election between when you submitted it and the next general election. They wouldn't show up on the voter rolls until they turn 18 under the current system, and if this law went into effect, it would then expand that to a bright line rule where you have, you know, 17-year-olds able to submit the application, but be the same process where they're in a pending status until they turn 18. Does that answer your question?
Thank you, Ms. Strother. This time I have one testifier left on the list, Holden Platt. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you would, just introduce yourself for the record, and we'll look forward to your testimony as well.
Hi, my name is Holden Platt, and I'd like to thank Chairman Sanders and the other members of the committee for having me here to testify. So I'm Holden Platt, as I stated. I'm 16 years old and a junior at Southwest High School in Minneapolis. I've come to speak to you today to support voter pre-registration. I take pride that I live in a country where I have the right to have my voice heard. Sadly, in the last election, over half of people ages 18 to 24 did not vote. This is an extremely critical problem because the voices of the future are not being heard. This bill resonates personally for me because I know what a difference youth engagement can make. In fifth grade, I saw something wrong with the way my school was running. At my K-8 school, only sixth graders and above were able to vote in student council elections. I saw this as a major problem in my community that needed to be fixed. After that election, I went to administration, identified the problem, and worked out a solution. In the next election, all students in the school were able to vote. In the months following that election, I saw a noticeable change in my school. All students were becoming involved in school decisions. For example, a first grader helped the student council establish a compost program at my school. You could see morale going up. You could see it on the faces of the kindergartners as well as the eighth graders. They knew they were making a change, and they really believed in the power that change was making. obviously there's a little more at stake in local, state, and national elections than in the race for student council, but the same principle applies. When young people are engaged in the political process, they become more engaged in their communities even after the election. Some 22 states in the United States have put into place some form of voter pre-registration. These states have on average 13% higher youth voter turnout, and they have also seen youth engagement increase in other ways. Voter pre-registration might encourage young people to start volunteering in their communities or prepare for their vote by following the news and being informed. In order to invest in the future of Minnesota, we need to start preparing young people to be engaged citizens. This is why I urge you to support voter pre-registration. Thank you so much for listening and considering the bill, and I'm now open to any questions that you have. I'll try to answer them to the best of my ability.
Thank you, Mr. Platt. Very well done as well. Thank you very much for your testimony and for coming today. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the testimony and the effort that you've demonstrated. Just wondering a couple of things, and maybe I guess this is to the representative, but so the records of the 17-year-olds that are submitted to the Secretary of State, and they are not, they're flagged as not being able to be on the registration roll, are those registrants, is the record of that available to anybody who requests in the same way that anybody who requests the voter, the registered voters in their district can receive those?
Thank you.
Chair Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck. I can be corrected if I am wrong, but the answer, as I know it, is no. They can't access that information.
Okay. Looks like Representative Erdahl got it right. Ms. Struthers sat back down. So. Representative Runbeck.
And Mr. Chair, then Mr. Thomas Cummins mentioned something about a blue card, and I'm not sure if I know what that is, but would that still follow the, or, you know, is that going to still be sent out to the registrants?
Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Runbeck. For that, I would need Ms. Struthers to tell me.
Welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, Julie Strother, again with the Secretary of State's office. Yes, the blue card that is sent out to verify, sent by non-forwardable mail, is still sent out to the voter when the voter registration is processed. But it, that card is sent out to the voter to verify their address, provide them information on where their polling place is when they're eligible to vote. And it has some general language on it about voter eligibility as well. Does that answer your question?
Representative Runbeck.
Yeah, pretty much, Mr. Chair. And so the confusion, there would not be confusion because the language would explain that the time that they're eligible to vote still remains after they're 18?
Ms. Strother.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, yes. The language right now does have the eligibility requirements on it. If this law went into effect, I imagine the language would probably be changed to make that clear. We've frequently update that language based on feedback from voters about different information that would be helpful for them. But the primary purpose of that card is to verify that the address that they provided is the address that we can send mail to because it's sent via non-forwardable mail.
Mm-hmm. Representative Brumbeck.
And Mr. Chair, one other question. Just thinking about my own daughter who went to school in California. So wondering how many students who are 17 will actually not be voting in the district in which they registered. And if it's a substantial number, it seems like there would be a lot of unnecessary, editing and, adding and retracting of data that isn't going to be useful.
Ms.
Is there any thought to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, we do in the ages of 18 to 24 especially see folks moving fairly regularly as they move from apartment to apartment and in college. We do know, though, a lot of young people vote from their permanent address, which is their parents' address, especially through their college years. But we also have systems in place in Minnesota that allows us to update people's address once they're part of the system to keep them updated and accurate, either through the National Change of Address Registry or the ERIC legislation that was passed last session allows us to ensure or better ensure that their address is up to date once they're in the system. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, great, thank you.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Representative Runbeck went down the line of questioning that I had, but I'll just start and take this opportunity by also thanking both of the testifiers. You did a marvelous job. And just to remark how wonderful and uplifting it is to see so many young people always, you know, but especially today in the hearing room. I mean, it definitely does give us hope, and I think it's very, very encouraging. So great job. I could ask another question, though, Ms. Struther, with regard to ERIC, and I am aware of that. I'm not aware of the intricacies of ERIC, and I think we should be, as a body, to understand so we can have some questions answered. Wondering if you could share that information with our committee as to how ERIC works, the legislation that was passed in the last biennium.
Ms. Struther.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, yes, ERIC was passed last legislative session. It is a bipartisan consortium of states that works on cleaning up and making more accurate our voter rolls. And so, like the national change of address system that we've been able to use, and I apologize, I don't know exactly how long we've been using it, but it was before my time at the office, we were able to update voters' registrations when we know that they've updated their registration with the United States, or their address with the United States Postal Service. ERIC allows us to both use data from other states when they've indicated that someone has moved on to, for example, the Wisconsin voter rolls. They will let us know then that that voter has moved on to the Wisconsin voter rolls. So we get data from other states about voter registration, comparing our data to theirs. But we're also able to use the Department of Public Safety's driver's license database. So if someone updates their driver's license with a more current address, we're able to update their voter registration address to ensure that we have the most current address on file for them in the voter registration database. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Pugh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I do have a few follow-up questions. I'm wondering if the Secretary of State's office can choose to use that information, or is it mandatory? You know, the information is there. Voters have notified or somehow that they've relocated. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering what the protocol is for a Secretary of State's office to, in fact, update the voter registration rolls.
Ms. Struther.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, actually, so I said we, but what I should be saying is actually the counties. We provide the information to the counties, and the counties are actually the ones processing and updating the voter registration list. Our office, though we maintain the statewide voter registration system, any modification to a voter registration happens at the county level and not at our level. So we provide the information for them to do that processing, but it's actually the counties that would process and update the information.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, again, not sure if you know the answer to this, but what is the requirement for the county once that information has been transferred to them? What is the requirement for them? Is there a window of opportunity during which they are required to update the voter registration roll?
Ms. Struther.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, I might ask Debbie, who Debbie Erickson from Crow Wing County, who can provide some information on the county processing and how they handle that on their end.
Thank you, Ms. Struther. Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Representative Pugh, with regard to your question, we do receive data that comes in through the ERIC system. It is required that it's processed at least within the time frames of prior to each election, at least 20 days prior to each election, records need to be updated. However, in most cases, best practices at the county levels do require, if not weekly or daily or monthly, updates of that information to keep the records as timely as possible. So the requirements are at a minimum at least 20 days before each election, but with most of the data, it is updated monthly, weekly, or in some cases daily as it comes through.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for that response. I appreciate that. I think my last question, unfortunately, is for Ms. Struther, and then I'll stop. And you know, the concern that I have, one of the concerns that I have with regard to this this bill, is just wondering for how long a
student's name, for example, might be, or anyone for that matter, who has relocated might be on the voter registration rolls. And maybe my discomfort with that is just that I don't know. But I do know that we have two adult children, both of whom have relocated. I think we mentioned that when we visited in my office prior to committee. But there, our son's name was still on the voter registration roll this past November. And in fact, he's moved to another state 2 years ago. And so I'm not sure if he didn't, you know, request or what the case is. But I share the same concern that Representative Runback brought up with regard to how many students, you know, may register, relocate. You know, there's a huge flux in this 18 to 24-year-old age.
Ms. Strother.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hugh, it is true that this is the group of very mobile individuals, 18 to 24, but this bill wouldn't change that. I mean, we still struggle with the issue of working to constantly maintain as accurate and up-to-date voter rolls, and I know the counties work on updating them when people move within the state, and we have these other lists, but this would just get folks engaged in the process mm-hmm. at the age of 17. I don't know, can't do much about the fact that they're going to be mobile. You know, 18 to 24, and I think most people in their mid-20s as you're establishing a career. But the purpose of this bill is to get folks engaged early on, and we have other mechanisms to try to ensure we have as accurate voter rolls as possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, kudos to the two young men that are here presenting this bill. I admire you very much. You'd mentioned, I think, the second testifier, and please tell me your last name again.
Platt.
Mr. Platt, you'd mentioned the number of voters in this age category from 18 to 24, and that declined in 2014. Did I understand that correctly?
I'm not sure. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott. I think, I'm not sure what election, but it said the rate went down 50%, a rate 22 points lower than the general population.
Okay.
Representative Scott.
I think maybe the second testifier has maybe some input on that. Go ahead.
Mr. Thomas Cummins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott. To answer your question, I do believe it did decrease. I know voting in general, voter turnout in general decreased more so than it usually does during an off-year election. But I'm pretty sure it did for young voters 18 to 24.
Yeah.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'd be interested in seeing is from presidential election to presidential election, because that seems to be the larger turnout, that's where I'd like to see the voter rolls for this age group, to see if there was some consistency with that age group from presidential election to presidential election, or if it's just kind of a anomaly or whatever. So I don't know if anybody has that data.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair?
At this time, we'll welcome back to the committee Secretary of State Simon for his comments. Welcome back, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate your patience here with this bill. I, too, want to thank the students. And just so you know, members, this came to my attention originally from students. And students who were not affiliated with any organization, any political party, this was just something that bubbled up, at least from my perspective, from students who were just interested in this idea and knew that 22 other states had done this, which you've heard about. I think one thing that's interesting is that the states that have done it are stereotypically blue states and stereotypically red states, from Hawaii to Florida. I include those two because there are studies that our office would be happy to forward to you. We can forward you the links. One of them 64 pages, so we didn't want to load you down here today. Studies that show that the increase in participation is anywhere from 8 to 13% higher for those students in the 18 to 24-year-old range that pre-registered versus those who didn't. And so there's some lengthy academic studies that purport to show that. I find those interesting. But I think it is important to note that this has been done broadly in this country on a bipartisan basis in states with very different political complexions. And I think that speaks to the overall kind of palatability of the bill. I would just say, though, it really is about getting good habits started early, I think, as others have said. And to Representative Scott's question about the turnout, we have a a handout here that we didn't bring copies for everyone. Happy to make those available. I have it here that just charts among young voters the turnout trends. Actually, it charts turnout based on all age ranges. And based on my read here in the last general election, those 18 to 24 voted at, I'm guessing this is about 18 or 19% based on the chart here. In the last presidential election in 2012, they voted at above 50%. And then in the last off-year election in 2010, they voted at above 20%. So apples-to-apples comparison from 2010 to 2014, two non-presidentials, it went from, again, I'm guessing here based on the chart, I would say roughly 22% to roughly 18 or 19%. So it did go down on an apples-to-apples basis, I would say. But members, I just thank you for your time and attention to this bill. It really is a student-led, youth-led kind of effort, and I hope it's received in that spirit. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Mr. Thomas Cummins, a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could also respond to Representative Scott's point. I think beyond just looking at presidential years, because those do tend to be higher, as we all know, in turnout, I think we should be looking to create consistent voter turnout that doesn't dip as low, but as Secretary Simon pointed out, that there is that decrease in the midterms. I think that's important to pay attention to, and if we can do anything to offset that, I think we should do it.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to mention something about Eric that I realize that people on this committee weren't necessarily on it last session, so we did pass that bipartisanly through here, a bill I carried, to have us become a part of this ERIC, electronic registration, forget what else means, but so that we would participate across the nation in voter cleanup of rolls. And so that if you're, someone's son or daughter moved to a different state and registered to vote there or voted there, then that would be a part of the ERIC cleanup, and it would be notified in Minnesota that they had now registered to vote someplace else. But if they move someplace else and don't register to vote, then we have no way of knowing where they are in the system. But the ERIC system is a very secure process of sending secure data in and then comparing it to make sure who's voting where and to clean up our voter rolls back to the county level. So it's a very good program that we're a part of.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, I promise that my comments will be brief, and if the if Mr. Thomas Cummings and Mr. Platt would come to the testifying table, I will ask them both the very same question. And just want 30 seconds, gentlemen, from each of you on your thoughts on this. When this country was founded, we had, I bet, very high voter turnout because of how this country was founded and the separation from England and so on and so forth. And I would suspect that voter turnout and civic participation was rather high. You're proposing this today as an idea to increase that participation that has dwindled. Question for both of you is, why in your estimations do you think there has been a dwindling of participation?
Mr. Thomas Cummins?
They both pointed at each other to see that.
I know. That's why I had to choose.
Go ahead. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. I think the reason, I'm not sure if I can account for all the way back to 1776, but as far as the past few years.
Excuse me. I couldn't vote. You had to have wealth and money and other things.
So I think just in the last few years, I really think I brought this point up a little bit in my testimony about how the Congress that we have right now just seems to be really insulated from the people through different things that they've done. But that's not reflective of this group particularly. This is why I like this group so much. It's because this group does seem extremely representative of the people, as you can see by me even being able to testify here. And I just don't think enough students see that sort of thing, and instead they just see what's on the news, which is more gridlock and shutdowns from Congress that happens just because they see them as catering to the really special interests that are just completely insulating them from any public influence. So then the problem is people see that and they just feel incredibly off put by that and feel like their voice doesn't matter. And I saw this especially, I'm going to college at Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin. And of course, voting is a very different story there, but I have many friends who just on election day said, no, I didn't vote. And then by the time the result is called, they're like, oh, man, I'm so angry about this. I should have voted. I'm like, yes, you should have. It's just because no one feels like their voice really counts anymore. And I think if we, like, in civics class, like I talked about, if we would, you know, hand out the registration forms during that time, it could really help to accelerate that interest in it. I'm sorry, I went over 30 seconds.
Mr. Platt.
It was good 15 now.
Okay, I'll take that.
Representative O'Driscoll, Chairman Sanders, I don't think there's a single reason why voter turnout has dwindled. I think it could just be the times. It could be that people are so caught up in all the, like Mr. Thomas Cummings said, there's all the gridlock, and they see it, and there's a negative connotation on government right now. And I think once a student, or personally, I got involved in some form of government, or it was student council even, once they see how exciting and how interesting that can be, they're really motivated, and I don't think that there is enough involvement in those groups now, and I think that if we can get back to more involvement in government, like Mr. Thomas Cummings said, being closer to our representatives and having that knowledge of government. I know at my school, in our AP government class that you take as a senior, they do hand out voting forms. And so they hand out voting registration forms. I really think there isn't one reason why it has dwindled, but I think that the solution is the voter pre-registration bill, 100%.
Thank you both. Members, we're getting close to running out of time. We still have several members on the list. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just briefly, the point that Representative O'Driscoll raised about voter turnout at the dawn of our great nation is an important one, because while voter turnout among eligible voters might have been high, it's important to know who those eligible voters were. And before our Constitution was written in 1787, the fact is voters... very often, we're always white, we're always men, we're always people who owned property, and we're very often required to be Protestant. Essentially, we were talking about allowing the people with the power in the country to have the voice of how our country was run. And through a number of constitutional amendments, through the people asserting their voice, expanded enfranchisement throughout this nation, to the point where when the 26th Amendment was passed, giving 18-year-olds the right to vote, voter turnout among the younger demographic actually was incredibly high, I think in excess of 70%. So we have had an electorate that has been very dedicated to making their voice heard. And what we're attempting to do, I believe, in this bill is to re-engage that voice of a populace that has felt underserved by their elected representation and has turned to drop out instead of getting active. And so I think that illustrates a really good story about voter turnout in our history, and it was a great place to start and to look at where we are today and to keep the great tradition that we've had in America of ensuring enfranchisement and supporting the voice of the people. So thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just a comment answer to the question earlier about how the voters' rolls get cleaned. It's my understanding that after so many years, I believe it's 4 years of non-voting, you're automatically dropped off voter rolls and you'd have to re-register. So our process is already set up to do some of that. So if Representative Runbeck mentioned her son, who's moved away 2 years ago, was still on the rolls, two more years he will automatically drop off if through the ERIC process he doesn't get flagged someplace else as having registered or voting someplace else.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. We have just a few minutes left. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify briefly on this bill? Welcome to the committee, Mr. McGrath. If you would, please state your name for the record and let us know who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Dan McGrath with Minnesota Majority. I feel a little bit like an ant at the picnic. Throw a little cold water on things, but I would urge caution with this bill. First of all, some states might find an advantage to something like this because they don't employ election day registration. It's much more important to be in registered advance in other states before you show up at the polling place. But because Minnesota has election day registration, I see this as completely unnecessary. I do appreciate that Ms. Struther from the Secretary of State's office provided some information on the routine that runs through SVRS to prevent people who are not yet of age from appearing on the rosters. However, there's nothing in the bill that specifies that they not appear on the rosters in the polling place, and it could potentially create a hole in the integrity of our election process that would become undetectable to the general public when organizations such as Minnesota Majority obtain public lists from SVRS. If someone did in fact vote while underage, that would be obscured from the research process. And we have in the past detected underage people voting using those public information lists, or at least the entries in SVRS would appear to have indicated that that was the case. So I urge caution with this bill. I don't think it's quite ready yet. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Anyone else in the audience? Mr. Schroeder, welcome to the committee. If you would introduce yourself, let us know who you represent, and look forward to your brief testimony.
It will be very brief, don't worry. My name is Jeremy Schroeder. I'm the executive director of Common Cause Minnesota. Just want to thank the chair as well as the committee for hearing this such an important issue. I'm actually foregoing most of my testimony and only responding to the last testifier you heard. This bill is more than about just registering people to vote. As you've heard from the amazing youth here today and other testifiers, this is about getting people to vote. This is about there still continue to have numerous barriers to voting. As we talked about how this country is founded and the barriers that have been broken down, we're getting there, but we're not there yet. And this bill is an important way to make sure the gap we have with youth voting and youth registration is taken care of. Thank you very much, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Schroeder. Seeing no further, Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just a comment to say, not of a question of you, but closing in the commentary. Irrespective of what happens with this bill, I want to congratulate you gentlemen for coming forward. We've got other members of your same demographics joining us here in the committee. One day you'll sit behind this table, and I applaud you for getting involved now. When I got involved in elementary school, I was a little bit of a political nerd, like Representative Halverson. I think we can agree on that one. We're sort of fixated on all things electoral. I got involved at a time that provided me some very interesting opportunities. I was able to travel overseas when there was an East Berlin, and there were people who didn't get the chance to vote. And I applaud your interest and would encourage you all to get involved, because one day this is all going to be yours. So irrespective of what happens with this bill, whether it happens or it doesn't happen, encourage the people who are around you to get involved, because this is all going to be yours one day. And thank you for coming to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Gentlemen, thank you both. You're very sharp. We'll give you each about 15 seconds of closing statements, and then we'll give Representative Erdahl closing remarks.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just respond to Mr. McGrath's point about having a specific provision in the bill that would forbid 16-year-olds from being listed as active registrants. Right now, there isn't really, I've pored over all the pertinent statute on this, there isn't really a place in statute to put that in there, and it would be very much a change from the current procedure where the county auditors and the Secretary of State establish a procedure by which someone is entered into the registration system. Beyond that, I would like to thank the committee and you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this bill. And then I know Representative Rumbeck was curious about the voter registration blue card, and if it's indicative of my interest in this, I have that card framed in my dorm. but then... And Representative Nash, you are correct about one thing. I do hope to run either 2020 or 2022. But I'll wait my turn. I'll wait my turn. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Platt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in reference to Representative Nash's comment, I just want to say that that what he said is why this bill is really important to me is because it will be us behind the table one day, and I really want the right people to be behind the table. And no matter who it is, as long as everyone's voice is heard, then we're doing what is right. And I want to thank the Chairman Sanders and also the members of the committee for having me here and letting me testify. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Platt. Chair Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think we had a good discussion today. I appreciate some of the questions and issues raised. I think most of them, I hope, were answered to your satisfaction. I will say that, you know, I looked in a dictionary last night, and I looked up the word conservative, and I read that through, the definition of conservative. Then I read the definition of liberal. Well, there were some distasteful things in there, but, you know, I read through it. And darn, I couldn't find anywhere in there where under the definition of liberal it said you want more people to vote. And so I'll let it sit at that.
Thank you, Chair Erdahl. With that, House File 391 is laid over. Members, thank you for a great committee, good discussion today. Thank you, Ms. Strother, for your participation and your help, as well as to the Secretary. With that, members, we are adjourned.